You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Sue Frederick. This is being recorded on April 17th. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. Bittersweet Demolition. El Paso and Douglas counties sue Colorado over sanctuary statutes. Planning Commission okays Amara annexation. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Bittersweet Demolition. Families gather at the Penrose property to grieve loved ones and seek closure, by Abby Sukup of the Gazette. Penrose. A chapter in the saga of the Return to Nature funeral home case is closing as demolition of the building that housed nearly 200 decomposing bodies began Tuesday. Impacted loved ones, law enforcement, Fremont County and El Paso County coroners, personnel, and officials with the Environmental Protection Agency came together on the Penrose property just south of Colorado 115 to grieve and seek closure. The gathering came just 2 days after the funeral home owners, John and Carrie Halford, returned to jail, this time facing federal fraud charges stemming from the gruesome discovery in October. The beginning of the demolition today hopefully marks a day of closure and the continued healing for all the victims associated with this horrific event, Fremont County Coroner Randy Keller said. Just before 9:40 a.m. Tuesday, EPA officials signaled the operator of a CAT excavator to begin the demolition. Those in attendance stood shoulder to shoulder at the metal barricades surrounding the property, watching as machinery made first contact with the building that held the remains of 189 people who were meant to be put to rest. You want to say the word relieving, but is it really? It's a bittersweet moment, said Samantha Naranjo, who is pro-demolition of the Penrose facility. I want it, the demolition, to be a step moving further from this place of horror, and I feel it's a step in the right direction, Naranjo said. The remains of Naranjo's grandmother, Dorothy Tardy, were discovered inside the Penrose facility in October. This is my first time here. It's weird seeing this building, Naranjo said. My grandmother should have never been in this building to begin with, so there's a lot of feelings on it. EPA spokesperson Catherine Jenkins said crews are working to have the building completely taken down in the next few days, as breaking down and hauling the materials to the Otero County landfill is anticipated to be the longest aspect of the process. So what they're going to do Tuesday is peel away the roof and see what the insulation is underneath. Depending on the type of insulation, more water may be needed for dust suppression, Jenkins said. They would like to get the building done in the next few days, and then we'll start loading. That's the part that takes the longest. As of 1 p.m. Tuesday, a Gazette photographer on the scene reported half of the Penrose building to be demolished. In addressing those in attendance, Keller confirmed 17 sets of remains discovered inside the Penrose facility have not yet been identified. Keller said the coroners will continue to work with DNA in pursuit of identifying the remaining individuals and bringing closure to impacted families. Carrie Wierick-Polacco, who used Return to Nature services in August 2022 after the death of her father, Ernest Skip Woolrich, is among those hoping the coroner's office work with DNA will bring her family closure. She said her father has not yet been identified by the coroner's office. Not knowing is the hardest thing. I can't begin to describe the feeling, Wierick-Polacco said. I figured the 17 they have left, no one has contacted us for DNA, and I took that as he probably isn't one of them. But they, Fremont County, told me they haven't reached out to anyone yet, so there's hope and more waiting, Wierick-Polacco said. Having hope helps. The Halford returned to jail Sunday, facing 16 additional federal felony charges along with the 260 criminal charges, including improper storage of 189 bodies, abuse of a corpse, money laundering, forgery, and theft in a lengthy, layered legal process that's underway in El Paso County. According to the El Paso County Sheriff's Office, the Halfords were released into FBI custody Monday and promptly whisked to Denver to face multi-count federal charges that broadly characterized their crimes as a scheme to defraud customers. Judge Scott Verhalak granted the U.S. Attorney Tim Nade's request for a 3-day continuance of the arraignment hearing, telling the judge he planned to argue the Halfords should remain in custody while they await trial, based on their track record. "There are grounds to believe they present a flight risk," Nade said. The Halfords will be back in federal court Monday. The Halfords are scheduled to appear in court in Colorado Springs for an arraignment hearing on June 6th. A jury trial is tentatively set for October. El Paso and Douglas counties sue Colorado over sanctuary statutes, by Noah Feisenstein of the Gazette. El Paso and Douglas counties have sued Colorado over its sanctuary statutes that restrict local law enforcement officials from working with federal authorities on illegal immigration, arguing they are unconstitutional and preempted by federal laws. The lawsuit, signaled in recent weeks in El Paso and Douglas counties, targets a 2023 law that restricts the ability of state and local governments from making agreements with federal immigration officials over the detention of immigrants who are unlawfully staying in the country, as well as a 2019 statute that blocks local law enforcers from arresting or detaining an immigrant solely on the basis of a federal immigration detainer. Colorado laws also prevent state judicial officials from sharing information with federal immigration officials. Governor Jared Polis is named in the lawsuit. "The nation is facing an immigration crisis," the complaint states. "The nation, the state, and local governments need to cooperate and share resources to address this crisis." Colorado House Bills 19-1124 and 23-1100 prohibit the necessary cooperation and create dangerous conditions for the state and migrants. The lawsuit said the two laws are illegal and unconstitutional because they violate the Colorado Constitution's provisions on intergovernmental relationships and distribution of powers. They are also preempted by federal immigration laws and regulations, the lawsuit added. Other counties are potentially interested in joining the lawsuit, according to Douglas County commissioners who spoke at a news conference on Monday morning. In pushing for the 2019 law, sponsors said any requirement that public safety agencies play a role in enforcing federal civil immigration laws can undermine public trust. Sponsors also said Coloradans have constitutional rights to due process and protection against unlawful detainment and seizures. And in passing the 2023 law, lawmakers said it is an inappropriate exercise of a state's police powers to detain individuals for federal immigration purposes, given its implication on foreign relations. Lawmakers also declared that phasing out state and local officials' involvement in civil immigration detention is warranted. District 2 Commissioner George Teal said the two laws violate several tenets of the Colorado State Constitution. "It is our intent to bring this suit specifically to address the illegal immigration crisis now present in this country." "A significant problem," Teal said, "is neither the counties nor the cities know how many immigrants have arrived into the area. We don't know who is here, and we're not allowed to approach federal agencies." More than 40,000 immigrants have arrived in Denver after illegally crossing America's southern border over the past 16 months. City officials do not know exactly how many have remained here, and they also do not know how many are looking for work. Early in the crisis, state and local officials had estimated that 70% intended to resettle elsewhere in the U.S., but bus, plane, and train tickets bought for immigrants traveling elsewhere suggest that fewer than half might have left. Douglas County has distanced itself from Denver, which also has sanctuary laws, and is poised to spend $90 million this year to feed, house, and transport the immigrants who traveled to the city after illegally crossing the southern border with Mexico. "The reason we are here today is the totality of the circumstances," said District 3 Commissioner Laura Thomas. "We are seeing what is going on in Denver, and we do not want that coming here to Douglas County." She likened the crisis to a perfect storm that could harm Douglas County's safety and quality of life. Nearby local governments, including the cities of Aurora and Colorado Springs, also have positioned themselves in stark contrast to Denver, saying they cannot afford to care for the immigrants. The Colorado Springs City Council approved a resolution that reaffirms it is not a sanctuary city in the hopes of discouraging immigrants from heading south from Denver. Council President Randy Helm said he believes, as officials at the southern border do, that being welcoming has led to the immigrant influx. When you offer someone free transportation, free shelter, I think it's only human nature people would be drawn to that, Helm said. El Paso County District 2 Commissioner Carrie Geithner said the state laws are out of touch with the needs of Coloradans. She added, "There are truly sanctuary state policies that we have to fight back against if we're going to keep our communities safe." The Gazette reached out to Governor Jared Polis for comment. "The governor's office will not comment on pending litigation," a spokesperson for Polis said. Planning Commission okays Amara annexation, development to support military. By Brianna Gent of the Gazette. Years-long plans to bring thousands of acres of sprawling prairie southeast of Colorado Springs into city boundaries and build up to 9,500 new homes inched forward Tuesday. In a 7-2 vote, the planning commissioners supported La Plata Community's proposal to annex about 3,200 acres in unincorporated El Paso County and surrounded on three sides by the neighboring city of Fountain. Then build the master-planned mixed-use community of homes and commercial space called Amara. Commissioners in favor of recommending the City Council approve the proposal said the development would support the area's military service members and their families, as well as future regional growth with much-needed housing. "This is in an area that needs support for the military. We need housing desperately in Colorado Springs," Commissioner Marty Ricketts said. "The only way to bring housing costs down is to increase our inventory." El Paso County expects to grow to about 1 million residents by 2050, or by another 250,000 people, developers said, as the commission considered their proposal over 3.5 hours. Colorado Springs will need to annex additional land to meet the estimated 34% increase in population expected over the next 26 years, they said. Amara is positioned to meet the demand by providing critical housing stock and associated commercial activity for approximately 9% of the projected growth, said Cody Humphrey, Director of Planning for La Plata Communities. The development's mix of neighborhoods, housing types, and a range of commercial space, schools, public safety facilities, and open space will create a sense of community, he said. The project is also estimated to generate $1.8 million in annual revenues for Colorado Springs after full build-out because of additional property and sales taxes that come along with annexation, developers said. Amara is planned to be constructed over 24 years in four phases. Commissioners Scott Hente and James McMurray, who voted against the proposal, questioned whether the annexation was a logical extension of Colorado Springs boundaries and if it would strain local public safety resources. If annexed into Colorado Springs, Amara would be a flagpole annexation along Bradley Road that lies within city boundaries, which functions as the pole or connection to the city. That section of the development along Bradley Road is split from the rest, the largest part, that is interrupted by state land and touches Fountain boundaries. "It feels like we're really pushing the envelope. If I was on the outside of this and saw the city boundary like this, I would probably assume there was some funky decision-making going on," McMurray said. Noting he liked many aspects of the proposal, McMurray said he couldn't support the developer's argument for its contiguity. "Ultimately, leapfrogging this far into the county today at this point doesn't feel like a totally logical decision as it relates to capital improvements or ability to provide services," he said. Although Colorado Springs Police Department Deputy Chief Mary Roseno said city police can reliably serve Amara, Hente wondered if the department would be able to do so once Amara is fully built out decades from now. The police department has for years struggled with staying and retention challenges, leaving it well under its full authorized strength of 818 sworn officers. But the department expects by September to reach those numbers, Roseno said. We will be at full strength based on our current size. Now, increase our population, and I worry about our ability to increase police, especially because we are a fiscally strained community, Hente said. Fountain officials in 2022 also raised concerns their law enforcement and fire resources would be strained by the new development, requiring Fountain police officers and firefighters to intervene in emergencies. No representatives from Fountain spoke Tuesday. Commissioner Andrea Slattery said the proposal fits with Colorado Springs' master plan guiding future development and will give future generations a place to call home. How do we serve the needs of our military, the needs of our kids and their kids, and give them a place to be and call home? This is an area of interest that has been identified. I think the area can and will become more contiguous with current city boundaries, even though the path to get there seems like a stretch in some ways, she said. Beyond honored. After 50 illustrious years as a Denver sports writer, Woody Page is to be inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. By Chris Thomason of the Gazette. After 50 illustrious years as a Denver sports writer, Woody Page will be inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. In the fall of 1953, Woody Page was a second grader at Cherokee Elementary School in Memphis, Tennessee. The school paper, the Cherokee Chit Chat, needed some news for the next edition. So Page's teacher approached the youngster during class and gave him an assignment. She came up to me and said, "You're writing the second grade news," Paige said. I said, "Why me?" She said, "You're the only one that can spell." So Paige looked around the room for something to write about. He eventually settled on chronicling how the classroom had just gotten a fishbowl with two goldfish, Carlos and Charlie. It was a mimeographed newspaper, and it came out and it said, "Second grade news by Woody Page," Paige said. All the other students said, "You can write?" And so I decided that day I was going to be a writer. It was the first article written by Page, and thousands more have followed. After working for various newspapers in Tennessee, he arrived in Denver in 1974 as a sports writer for the now-defunct Rocky Mountain News. He moved to the Denver Post as a sports columnist in 1981, and in 2016 to the Gazette in Colorado Springs, and later also the Denver Gazette. Page has won more than 150 writing awards during his illustrious career. He branched into radio and television, becoming nationally known for the quips he has made in his thousands of appearances on ESPN's Around the Horn. And on Wednesday night, Page, 77, will be inducted at the Hilton Denver City Center into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame. "I always considered him a guy that, if you're going to get the top story, it's coming from Woody," said Mike Shanahan, head coach for Super Bowl wins by the Broncos in the 1997 and 1998 seasons. "Whether it was the Broncos or the Avalanche, I don't care what sport it was, Woody was the center of every top article." Part of Colorado history. For the past 50 years, Page has been the most recognizable sports writer in Colorado. He has covered more than 40 Super Bowls, including three won by the Broncos. He has chronicled three Stanley Cup victories by the Avalanche, the Nuggets' first NBA title last year, and countless other national and state events, including 14 Olympics. "You can't write the history of Colorado sports without Woody Page," said Mark Kisla, a longtime sports columnist who rejoined Page when Kisla moved to the Gazette in January. "Fact of the matter is, Page has written much of that history with a unique style that can be funny, controversial, and insightful, often all at the same time." Page has touched readers with columns on the deaths of his father, Woodrow Page Sr., in 1975, his sister Toni in 2006, and his mother Billy in 2019, and on the birth of his daughter Shannon in 1977. He once exposed vendors at Mile High Stadium for not checking IDs at a minor league baseball game when he was able to prove that underage customers were easily able to buy beer. He won a number of suicide prevention awards after he wrote a column following the 2010 suicide of Broncos player Kenny McKinley about how Page himself had planned to commit suicide in 2002. Page has played blackjack with Michael Jordan. He drank beer with Jimmy Buffett. He had a role in the movie Rocky Balboa. He has played a clown in a circus. He flew with the U.S. Navy's Blue Angels and got sick in the process. Page and longtime Preps writer Scott Stocker will become the sixth and seventh sports writers to be inducted into the Colorado Sports Hall of Fame, following Charles Poss Parsons, 1982, Leonard Ken, 1985, Dick Connor, 1993, Frank Haraway, 1994, and Dorothy Mock, 2014. Former Nuggets forward Bill Hanslick, elected to the Shrine in 2004, called Page's induction well-deserved, but did quip that he will become the least athletic person that ever has gotten into the Hall of Fame. Page doesn't deny it feels a bit odd to be inducted into a Hall of Fame that primarily includes athletes, and he just might note in his induction speech that there should be a wing at the Hall devoted to writers. I think of my dad. One thing is for sure about Page's induction speech. He will talk plenty about his father. I'm beyond honored, but as I will say in my speech, I'm honored to accept this for my dad, Page said. He is the real Woodrow Page. I'm Woodrow Page, Jr. His father suffered from diabetes throughout his life and died at age 42 after having seven different amputations on his left leg. The disease limited what Page Sr. could do in his life, but not in what he sought to do for his son. After the second grade, I wanted to be a writer. We couldn't afford a typewriter, and my father took a second job fixing TV sets so that he could save up enough money over the years to buy me a typewriter, Page said of his father, whose primary job was selling men's clothes at Schaumburg's, a Memphis department store. I still have that typewriter at home on a desk. It's an old beater. It's probably the most meaningful thing I have. I look at it every day and I think of my dad. The Olivetti Latera 22 portable typewriter, now about 70 years old, got quite a workout during Page's days in Tennessee. He became editor of the newspaper at Whitehaven High School and sports editor when he was 16 of the weekly Whitehaven Press. He was editor of the Daily Beacon at the University of Tennessee and worked at the Knoxville Journal and Memphis Commercial Appeal before moving on to Denver. At the Commercial Appeal, Page, not long after he had graduated from college, covered civil rights and wrote about the 1968 assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. in Memphis. He became, at 23, a sports columnist at the paper, fulfilling a goal he had set in high school. I wrote a column for the school newspaper that said when they played the national anthem at football games, everybody was standing up, but there was no flagpole, and so people didn't know where to look, Page said. So I wrote that the county should build a flagpole so people can look at the American flag. I go out the next week, and they had built a flagpole, and I thought that I can influence people. I can do this in life. Page wasn't just writing when growing up in Memphis. He also was hanging out with Elvis Presley. Page lived in the same government housing project as the Presley family. Page would stop by in the early 1950s and watch the aspiring singer who was 11 years older. I was 4 or 5, and I would listen to him play his guitar and sing on the front porch, Page said. We became lifelong friends because I was his first fan. When Page was in high school and Presley had become world famous, the singer would invite him to Graceland and to a Memphis amusement park that would be opened at times between midnight and 6 a.m., for only Presley and his guests. Page played touch football with Presley and was involved in a game at Graceland in 1960 when the singer fell and broke his right pinky, which became an international news story. After joining the Commercial Appeal, Page began to be well-known in the South. He covered the ABA's Memphis Tams and Southeastern Conference sports. He chronicled Archie Manning, the father of former NFL quarterbacks Peyton and Eli Manning, when he was a star quarterback at Mississippi. He always had a good wit about him, said Archie Manning, who remained close to Page and then looked on when Peyton starred for the Broncos 2012 to 2015. Move to Colorado. By 1974, Page was ready to move to a bigger paper. He accepted an offer from the Atlanta Journal before the Rocky Mountain News asked him to fly to Denver for an interview. Page didn't know if he would be a fit for the Rocky, and he showed up for the interview with long hair that he said made him look like some creep out of a hippie movie. He also wasn't wearing socks, which has become one of his trademarks. Thinking he might not get the job, Page came to Denver with an empty suitcase that he soon filled with Coors beer to take back to Memphis for an expected farewell party for a move to Atlanta. Coors at the time wasn't sold in the eastern United States. They said in the interview, "You're our guy because you're opinionated and you look different and you write different than anybody." They said, "We'll give you $10,000 more than Atlanta is offering you," Page said. "So I went back to the Holiday Inn and started drinking the Coors. I thought, gosh, that was the most money I'll make in my life. I was the highest paid journalist in Colorado at $16,000. Page was assigned to cover the Nuggets and write 5 columns a week. He was told his hiring was needed for the paper to overtake the rival Denver Post in circulation. But some of his initial columns did not thrill everyone. "The Broncos had been bad for so long, and I wrote, 'I hate to tell you people, but your team stinks,'" Page said. "So I get a call from head coach John Ralston's PR guy saying the coach wants to see you in his office. Ralston says to me, 'Son, get a haircut and don't write negative things. We don't write negative things in Denver.' I said, 'It's not going to be like that anymore.' And I don't know if he ever talked to me again." Page said Ralston, who died in 2019, later kicked him off the team plane because he was improperly dressed. He recalls wearing a T-shirt with an emblem on the front for the rock band Blood, Sweat, and Tears. Covering the Nuggets, Page encountered some more friction, but he remained undeterred. "I remember Woody calling the Nuggets coaches and GM the Three Stooges," said former Nuggets star David Thompson, referring to executive Carl Shear, head coach Larry Brown, and assistant coach Doug Moe. "They didn't like that too well. I thought it was hilarious. He'd always try to throw in a little jab and have biting commentary, but I liked reading his stuff." Former Nuggets star and later head coach Dan Issel said players on the team once voted not to talk to Page after he had written a negative article. But Issel, who had known Page since he was covering the Tams, went undercover during the ban. "I talked to Woody on the phone so none of my teammates would know that I was communicating with him," Issel said. "Woody could tear you up pretty good because he was so clever, but I always enjoyed reading it anyhow." Page moved on to cover the Broncos during their epic Orange Crush season of 1977, when they made the playoffs for the first time and advanced to Super Bowl XII, before losing 27-10 to Dallas. Page chronicled the season in Orange Madness, the first of 9 books he has written. "It was incredible," Page said. "People had orange toilets. They painted their houses orange. They named their kids after Broncos players." Quarterback Craig Morton said Page that season didn't hesitate to kick my butt in the paper when he played poorly, but he admired him since he called it like he saw it. For cornerback Lewis Wright, it took some time to get used to Page. "I remember once at training camp in Fort Collins, there were a couple of players saying, 'Woody Page is mean. He's writing smack. Don't let Woody around,'" Wright said. "But I got to the point where I thought Woody was just doing his job. I really like Woody now. When I first thought he was writing the negative content, he was just writing the truth." Switching newspapers. After that 1977 season, Page became only a sports columnist for the Rocky Mountain News and no longer was on a beat. And in 1981, the Denver Post came after him. The paper had been acquired by the Los Angeles Times and was looking to one-up the Rocky, which had taken a circulation lead with help from Page. They offered him a whopping 4-year, $500,000 contract, leading to his annual salary of $125,000, dwarfing the $36,000 he was making at the Rocky. He became the highest paid sports columnist in the country. I know this sounds terribly egotistical, but they documented that 40,000 readers went with me to the Denver Post, and they passed the Rocky Mountain News back, Page said. So I paid my way. Of course, there were some instances when it looked as if Page might end up losing some money. He was involved in several legal matters. In the early 1980s, Adrian Brooks, a player for the Denver Avalanche of the Major Indoor Soccer League, had threatened not to suit up for a playoff game unless he was paid additional money. Page went on television and said he should be run out of town. Brooks then sued Page for $16 million. On the first day of the trial, Doug Moe testified that I called everybody bleeps, said Page, referring to the then Nuggets coach. The judge threw it out. After the Colorado Rockies of the NHL moved in 1982 to become the New Jersey Devils, Page called owner John McMullen a swamp swill salesman. McMullen sued him for $20 million, but that case also was thrown out. In 2001, Page became embroiled in a highly publicized legal matter that even the New York Times covered. When now named Empower Field at Mile High first opened, it was known as Invesco Field. Page wrote that employees of Invesco Funds in Denver called it the diaphragm because of the structure's resemblance to a birth control device. Invesco, which had paid $60 million over 20 years for naming rights of the stadium, threatened a $50 million lawsuit against the Denver Post, claiming what Page wrote was false. But it soon was determined the story was true, and that an Invesco executive, after some drinking at a Denver restaurant, told Page about the nickname and handed him his business card. They dropped everything after 4 days, and they fired the guy after they found out who it was, Page said. It was around this time Page also was becoming well-known nationally. 4 years earlier, he had written a column before a Broncos playoff game against the second-year Jacksonville Jaguars and called them the Jagwads, while mocking them as a goofy team and ripping their city. Well, the Jaguars shocked the Broncos 30-27 in January 1997, and on national television, Coach Tom Coughlin held up Page's column and said it motivated the team. ESPN. In the late 1990s, ESPN began a series of interviews with Page for the Sports Century series, in which it counted down the top 50 athletes of the 20th century. Page recalls being in Panama on December 25, 1999, and surprisingly seeing himself on television talking about Michael Jordan, who was number one on the list. A few years later, ESPN officials, having liked Page's Sports Century work, asked if he wanted to be a part of a new sports talk show called Around the Horn. They said, "You'll be a national TV star," Page said. I said, "I don't care about being a national TV star. I was 54 or something, and I just wanted to do my job." But then they told me what it would pay, and I said, "Where do I show up?" The show paid Page $2,500 a week when it debuted November 4, 2002. Page had his doubts on about how it would last, but the show is still going strong. Page has appeared on the show more than anyone, over 3,000 episodes, and one more times over 670. He is known for showing a blackboard on television on which he has scrawled witty phrases. In 2004, Page took 2 years off from column writing to move to New York to appear on Around the Horn and various other shows, including Cold Pizza, which has long since been canceled. Gil Whiteley, a longtime Denver radio broadcaster and one of Page's closest friends, recalls visiting him a few times there. "People would go crazy when he would walk down the street in New York," said Whiteley, now with Mile High Sports. "They'd scream, 'Hey, Woody!'" But Woody is actually a shy guy when you meet him in person. He's not the guy he plays on TV. Kisla said Page is like Norm from Cheers, and that he can't walk into any sports bar in America without somebody shouting, "Woody!" Page recalls once going into the New England locker room after a playoff game, and the Patriots' 5 starting offensive linemen walked over to me and said, You're our favorite guy on TV. This is a whole new world for me, Page said, about gaining fame on television in the latter part of his media career. I'll hear from people, we love you on TV. But I would just say you can't go to bed thinking about that. I would be a miserable person if I did that. I'm just trying to have fun on TV. I'm trying to bring a sense of humor that maybe sports isn't too serious. And I'm kind of funny and I have a blackboard. Most important column. Against this backdrop of having achieved national fame, Page revealed in a 2010 column after the suicide of McKinley that he had had planned to commit suicide before the Broncos played at San Francisco on September 15, 2002. Page, who had been taking prescription drugs to combat deep depression, said he planned to drink heavily in Napa before going to drown himself in the Pacific Ocean. I had gone to a psychiatrist and was given every drug in the whole world, Page said. I was within hours of getting on the plane to go to Napa, and I had it all figured out. In the column, Page wrote that Whiteley, whom he called a brother to me, showed up at his door and learned what he was thinking. He wrote that Whiteley got Page's doctor, Alan Schreiber, on the phone. Whiteley took Page to Rose Hospital. He remained there for 3 weeks while doctors took away his belt, his nail clippers, and anything he might be able to use to harm himself. Doctors eventually diagnosed that Page was diabetic, which had contributed to his depression, and he was on the road to recovery. It must have been some calling for me to write that column. It saved a lot of lives, said Page, who received what has been estimated as 35,000 emails and voicemails about the column, some from people who had contemplated suicide. Helping others with that column is something in my life I am very proud of. Page calls it the most important column he has written and said Schreiber will be at Wednesday's banquet. Whiteley, who also will attend, said he didn't know beforehand that Page would be writing that column and that he never has spoken to Page about the 2002 incident since then, even though the two have remained close. It changed his life completely around, Whiteley said of Page getting the help he needed. I'm very proud of that. Enjoying every day. Page said he's doing quite well these days. He left the Denver Post in 2016 because he didn't like the direction the paper was going under new management. He said his tenure at the Gazette and the Denver Gazette has been great because they care about journalism, and that's the truth. I have no problems, Page said. I don't drink, I don't smoke, I've lost 60 pounds, I'm in the gym every day, I'm the healthiest I have ever been in my life, I'm the happiest I've been in my life, I'm not sitting here thinking of retiring, I'm enjoying every day. And Page on Wednesday will stand at a podium and talk about his 70 years as a writer, including 50 since he showed up in Colorado in 1974. My dad, if he were here, would say, son, you did okay, he said. Partnership. Colorado AG Transportation Department team up to address airline complaints by Sage Kelly of the Gazette. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser and U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg announced a partnership on Tuesday, creating an efficient way to review airline passenger complaints and aviation violations. The Airline Passenger Protection Partnership will work to streamline the Attorney General's office and the U.S. Department of Transportation's handling of consumer complaints against air travel companies in a time when complaints about flight disruptions, lack of refunds, and lost or delayed baggage continue to be core passenger concerns, according to a news release from Weiser's office. Buttigieg was in Denver on Tuesday for the announcement and to meet with Governor Jared Polis and Denver Mayor Mike Johnston. Consumers deserve to be treated fairly, know what they're getting, and get everything they pay for when they fly, Weiser said in the release. This agreement and partnership with the Transportation Department will allow my office to directly serve Colorado consumers when they file complaints about unfair or deceptive airline business practices and creates a process to ensure DOT prioritizes complaints we refer. Weiser is one of 18 state attorney generals that signed the bipartisan Airline Passenger Protection Partnership Agreement, according to a news release from the Department of Transportation. Under the agreement, the Attorney General's office will investigate consumer complaints against air carriers, ticket agents, and other travel companies supervised by the Transportation Department. The Attorney General's office will work to resolve complaints directly. If necessary, the complaints will be raised to the Transportation Department's Office of Aviation Consumer Protection to determine next steps, according to the release. The partnership will ultimately work to investigate airline complaints for unfair or deceptive practices, ensure airlines cooperate with state investigations, create a fast-track action system for attorney generals and the Transportation Department to prioritize misconduct case referrals and share access to a consumer complaint database, according to the release. Before the agreement, the Transportation Department was responsible for airline consumers and complaints. Carriers are not legally required to respond to state investigations. Consumer advocates have pushed to expand enforcement power to the states, but the full House and a key Senate committee declined to include the proposal in pending legislation. During the pandemic, we actually got more complaints about airline traffic than any other topic, and it was frustrating because the state had no authority to investigate the complaints, Weiser said Tuesday. While Weiser believes that Congress should give states power to enforce airline consumer protection laws, we didn't wait for Congress to act, he added. Consumer groups praised the agreement, though they too would rather see Congress write into law the power of states to regulate consumer protection rules. This is the next big thing, said William McGee, an aviation expert at the American Economic Liberties Project, which opposes industry consolidation. We don't look at this as a threat to DOT's authority. We look at it as the states assisting DOT, which doesn't have the staff to handle all the complaints they get. The agreement will last 2 years. Colorado and the Transportation Department could agree to extend it at two-year intervals after the agreement ends. This is a partnership that will greatly improve DOT's capacity to hold airlines accountable and to protect passengers, Buttigieg said Tuesday. Buttigieg pointed to travelers whose flights are canceled and then must wait days for another flight or pay more to fly home on another airline. Things like that are a violation of passenger rights, and we are seeing far too many cases of that, he said. California, New York, Illinois, Connecticut, Maine, Maryland, Michigan, Nevada, New Hampshire, North Carolina, Oklahoma, Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and Wisconsin, plus the District of Columbia, the Northern Mariana Islands, and the U.S. Virgin Islands, all officially signed the agreement. A December report on transportation data from the U.S. Public Interest Research Group found that consumer complaints against U.S. airlines were on track to break records again in 2023. Despite 2022 being a record-breaking year for consumer complaints against airlines, with 47,591 complaints overall, the first 5 months of 2023 saw a 109% increase from the same period in 2022, according to the report. Travelers filed 38,135 complaints against U.S. and foreign airlines in the first 5 months of 2023, according to the report. Nearly 35% of those complaints involved flight issues, such as cancellations and delays. Around 20% involved refunds, or lack thereof. The full year of consumer complaint data has yet to be released by the Transportation Department due to a high volume of complaints against airlines and ticket agents received by the agency, the department has said in various reports. Since Buttigieg became secretary in 2021, the Transportation Department has issued over $164 million in penalties against airlines for consumer protection violations. In comparison, the department collectively issued less than $71 million in penalties between 1996 and 2020. Shakshuka. Try this Middle Eastern comfort food that is perfect for any meal of the day, by Patricia Farney of the Gazette. Shakshuka. Ever heard of it? According to Alan Shaya, in his cookbook, Shaya, An Odyssey of Food, My Journey Back to Israel, Shakshuka is eggs poached in a spicy, savory tomato sauce and my go-to when I show up at someone's house and everyone is hungry. Shaya is a 2-time James Beard Award winner and owner of 3 Israeli restaurants, one of which is in Denver called Safta, where shakshuka is a featured dish on the menu. He went on to write, "Chances are there are eggs and a can of tomatoes on hand in most homes. Part of the fun is making this dish your own. But one word of advice, try it with a zhug, a spicy Yemeni green chili sauce, like the Middle Eastern approach to pesto. Its fresh, herbal heat is the perfect finishing touch." The backstory. Shakshuka is a North African dish and is said to have originated in Tunisia. Shakshuka is the original spelling, while S-H-A-K-S-H-U-K-A is the more popular and simplified version. Shakshuka is an Arabic word that translates to a mixture, and shakshuka is a Hebrew word that means all mixed up. Either way, it's pronounced shakshuka. And as Shaya explained, in its simplest rendition, the recipe is a mildly spicy tomato sauce with raw eggs broken into the simmering sauce to be poached. But in the hands of chefs, shakshuka can be transformed into spectacular entrees enjoyed for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it's becoming a trendy restaurant food. Local chef Kathy Wuerl at the Margarita at Pine Creek says, "We love this dish for many reasons. One being it's a hearty vegetarian one-pan dish loaded with flavor, color, and comfort. We like to feature it off and on for lunch specials." Wuerl especially likes to make shakshuka during harvest season. That's when tomatoes are juicy and sweet, and peppers like cubanelles or cono del toros are deep red and overflowing at the farmers markets, she said. "But our version of shakshuka can transition from late summer to the winter and spring using good quality, fire-roasted canned tomatoes and jarred peppers found at most grocery stores." Her recipe follows, which can be adjusted to feed 2, 4, or 8. And the best part, she emphasized, you only need to use one pan. Wuerl's version of shakshuka is based on flavors of Morocco, where she spices the tomato base with harissa. This North African red chili spice mixture is made of a few simple ingredients, including various chilies, warm spices, and seasoning. Wuerl has also offered her recipe for the Margarita's Harissa House Blend. "You can make shakshuka as spicy or as mild as you desire," Wuerl said. "My favorite way to eat this dish is for a midday brunch meal, although dinner is perfect too, topped with dollops of whipped feta or yogurt, pickled onions, and lots of fresh herbs. And you must not forget some big hunks of crusty bread to sop up all that richly spiced sauce and jammy egg yolks." Shakshuka without borders. Pick up cookbooks for vegetarian dishes or from other cultures, and you'll likely find a recipe or two featuring eggs cooked in a sauce, which can be thought of as other versions of shakshuka. For instance, there's a green shakshuka made with power greens like spinach, kale, and broccoli, with spices and eggs nestled in the greens. When you think about Mexican huevos rancheros, made with poached eggs served on tortillas with a tomato chili sauce, beans, rice, and some guacamole, the dish is similar to shakshuka. Or the Italian uova al purgatorio, eggs in purgatory, is made up of the same ingredients as shakshuka: tomatoes, peppers, and Italian spices. In Spain, you can eat pisto manchego, which is made with a sunny-side-up egg placed on an eggplant and tomato stew, sometimes with chorizo. All of these are similar to the shakshuka you can find in Israel. Shakshuka can be seen in so many shapes and forms across the country and world. You can find it served with bread, in a pita, or placed inside a whole loaf of bread made into a bowl. However you serve shakshuka, just give it a try. It may quickly become a go-to recipe in your regular weeknight menu roundup. Residential by Marissa Ventrelli with ColoradoPolitics.com. Governor Jared Polis signs a bill that clarifies occupancy limits. Governor Jared Polis has signed a measure that eliminates residential occupancy limits for unrelated individuals, though the new law still allows local government regulation tied to health, safety, or welfare. House Bill 1007 prohibits local governments from enacting or enforcing occupancy limits based on familial relationships, provided that health and safety standards, as well as local building and fire codes, are adhered to. Supporters of the bill say it will increase access to affordable housing, an issue the state has been grappling with for years. It is just one of the housing-related bills the legislature is considering this session. Critics said it chips away at local control, arguing municipalities, not the state, know how best to regulate housing issues. I am thrilled to take this bold step today to cut red tape and get the government out of the business of telling people who they can live with, Polis said. This is one of many comprehensive steps Colorado is taking to ensure Coloradans can live in the communities they choose, near jobs and transit hubs. I thank the sponsors for their work on this legislation to create more housing options Colorado can afford. The bill was sponsored by Representatives Manny Rutinel, Democrat of Commerce City, and Javier Mabry, Democrat of Denver, and Senators Julie Gonzalez, Democrat Denver, and Tony Exum, Democrat Colorado Springs. Occupancy limits that are not based on health and safety concerns worsen our housing shortage, making it even more difficult for Coloradans to find housing, Mabry said. Our new law will expand housing options for all Coloradans so they can choose a living situation that works for their budget and keeps them close to their community. Strict occupancy limits can reduce housing options and push folks out of their communities, added Exum. Prohibiting occupancy limits would give residents the freedom to choose their living situation and who they live with. This new law will allow families to live in a structure that's best for them, without the interference of occupancy limits. The bill takes effect July 1st. In February, Aurora Council member Francois Bergen said the city should oppose the bill, arguing the local government knows its housing situation better than the state does. We should be making those decisions as our own jurisdiction, not mandated by the state that doesn't know our particulars in our different neighborhoods, Bergen said. Mayor Mike Komen agreed, saying it's not about a single change, but rather about the overall chipping away at the city's ability to determine its housing regulations. Other council members disagreed. If the city opposes the bill simply because it slowly chips away at the city's ability to make decisions, then council members should oppose every bill, because in some way or another, many of them impact Aurora, council member Curtis Gardner argued. Simpson executor plans to fight payout. Las Vegas. The executor of O.J. Simpson's estate says he will work to prevent a payout of a $33.5 million judgment awarded by a California civil jury nearly three decades ago in a wrongful death lawsuit filed by the families of Simpson's ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and her friend, Ron Goldman. Simpson's will was filed last week in a Clark County court in Nevada, naming his longtime lawyer, Malcolm Laverne, as the executor. The document shows Simpson's property was placed into a trust that was created this year. Laverne told the Las Vegas Review-Journal that the entirety of Simpson's estate has not been tallied. Under Nevada law, an estate must go through the courts if its assets exceed $20,000. Simpson died Wednesday without having paid the lion's share of the civil judgment that was awarded in 1997 after jurors found him liable. With his assets set to go through the court probate process, the Goldman and Brown families could be in line to get paid a piece of whatever Simpson left behind. Laverne, who had represented Simpson since 2009, said he specifically didn't want the Goldman family seeing any money from Simpson's estate. "It's my hope that the Goldmans get zero, nothing," he told the Review-Journal. Then, specifically, "And I will do everything in my capacity as executor or personal representative to try and ensure that they get nothing." Although the Brown and Goldman families have pushed for payment, Laverne said there was never a court order forcing Simpson to pay the civil judgment. The attorney told the Review-Journal that his particular ire at the Goldman family stemmed in part from the events surrounding Simpson's planned book titled If I Did It. Goldman's family won control of the manuscript and retitled the book, If I Did It, Confessions of a Killer. Simpson earned fame and fortune through football and show business, but his legacy was forever changed by the June 1994 knife slayings of his ex-wife and her friend in Los Angeles. He was acquitted of criminal charges in 1995 in a trial that mesmerized the public. Goldman's father, Fred Goldman, the lead plaintiff, always said the issue was never the money. It was only about holding Simpson responsible. And he said in a statement Thursday that with Simpson's death, the hope for true accountability has ended. The Goldman and Brown families will be on at least equal footing with other creditors and will probably have an even stronger claim, as Simpson's estate is settled under terms established by the trust created in January. The will lists his four children and notes that any beneficiary who seeks to challenge provisions of the will shall receive, free of trust, $1 and no more in lieu of any claimed interest in this will or its assets. Simpson said he lived only on his NFL and private pensions. Hundreds of valuable possessions had been seized as part of the jury award, and Simpson was forced to auction his Heisman Trophy, fetching $230,000. Thank you for joining us for the Colorado Springs Gazette, read by Sue Frederick.
AfterSight presents your low vision resource of the day, the Be My Eyes app. This free app uses sighted volunteers and/or artificial intelligence to aid in the completion of tasks to help blind and low vision users lead more independent lives. Download it in the App Store or learn more by visiting www.bemyeyes.com.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777. You're listening to AfterSight.